On radio. On radio. More of the good stuff. CliffCentral.com. Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show. Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
It's just gone 1 o'clock on a Tuesday, so that means it's time for the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. I'm your host, Dilly Sharalumbus, and I'm joined in an intimate setting for two. Candlelights are glowing in the background. Myself and Ranjini Munasamy, our senior political editor and associate editor at the Daily Maverick. Welcome, Ranjini.
Hi there, Dilly. Nice to be back.
Yes, it is.
You guys had fun without me last week.
We did.
I was getting withdrawal symptoms.
Well, I'm glad you can make it back this time to join us.
And I'm not like in some hick town in Mpumalanga talking to you. I'm actually here.
Which is always great. Last week we had Gushwell Brooks, Simon Allison, and John Stupart in, and we noted in that show that we had talked almost exclusively about international goings on in Nigeria, and obviously after the Charlie Hebdo attack in France, and we noted how quiet things were on the South African front, and whether that our noise and newsmakers were still on holiday, but the consensus was that the journalists were still on holiday. And since then, things have sort of heated up a little bit in the world of media and journalism in South Africa, thanks to a piece on the Daily Maverick by Marianne Tam. That sort of exploded. That was on the back of pictures that were posted on social media by the chief editor at the Independent Group and the opinions editor at the Independent Group, who posted photos of themselves wearing ANC regalia at the ANC's 103rd celebration party in Cape Town. And the question was asked by Marianne, is this the way to go? Should editors, especially senior editors at a publication that claims to be independent, should they be posting their affiliations on social networks for the public out there? Does it bring their independence into question? Does it bring their objectivity into question? Does it break any rules that the South African National Editors Forum has laid out for editors? And on the back of that, a huge stink was kicked into play. What are your thoughts on the whole matter?
Well, firstly, just to say about the lull, I think locally, it was because the noisemaker in chief was on honeymoon, if you remember. the thing is with December is that the way South Africa works, for some reason there's a lot of political activity in December and then it's shuts down dead. And then
things like conferences.
Yes,
and
so there was a lot of political activity in December, which is why you found like political journalists still running, the last lap just before the Christmas shutdown. And then the first event of the year, as usual, is the ANC's January 8th anniversary celebrations. And it's, traditionally a huge event in South Africa because the ANC is what it is. It's still the biggest liberation movement on the continent. It still calls itself a liberation movement, even though it's a fully-fledged political party. And because it has, such a rich legacy and so many heroic figures that need to be celebrated, the difference now is that the romance of the ANC is waning, since it's been in government.
The honeymoon period is over.
Yes, their honeymoon period is definitely over. So I think the way the ANC is celebrated is different. So, for example, on the Friday night, they had the fundraising dinner in Cape Town with, all the high flyers in big business there. There were reports that some people had to pay up to 3 million rand to sit near President Jacob Zuma. So, that tells you the kind of thing it is. And the funny thing is that Cyril Ramaphosa was speaking at that dinner, and he said, it's so much like the formation of the ANC 103 years ago, because they must have had to sit down to dinner. Except like nobody had to shell out 3 million bucks to do so. But he said, I could imagine the leaders of the ANC then sitting around to break bread. So I suppose breaking bread is a relative term. The next day's rally, you know, it's all about President Jacob Zuma's speech. And as you know, President Jacob Zuma is not the world's greatest speaker. And there wasn't really much that he announced that, that deals with current issues, the current crisis. So it was quite interesting that, you know, there was not much to discuss and debate after the ANC, celebrations. But the thing that came out of it was this hullabaloo about the media, the role of the media, and particularly because Karima Brown and Vugani Umdia are quite controversial figures in the South African media, and because independent newspapers has been caught in controversy of late.
Only a week before had again courted controversy by issuing an apology for Max du Preez's
column,
to the president.
Yes.
And, you know, if you read into Max's sort of resignation letter, you know, he wasn't consulted on the matter. He still believes that, you know, he was factually correct in that, and no apology needed
yes,
to be issued.
Yes, the issue at hand is whether he was justified in saying, you know, indicating that President Jacob Zuma is corrupt. And it's interesting now yesterday with the DA's court case, and it's still that same broad issue, you know, whether there is a legitimate reason to call Jacob Zuma or refer.
Say to the stole the money.
He stole money and, you know, the corruption and things. And I think it's a big tragedy for South Africa that we have to have these kinds of debates about our president. But coming back to the issue of, about the media, I think, you know, Karima Brown and Vugani Mdee are there at independent newspapers for a specific purpose. They are there to carry out an agenda. And they are doing it without any apology. Mm-hmm. I think that they want to make a point, that they want to what they call transform independent newspapers to, or independent media to be more aligned to the ruling party and to the government. Mm-hmm. And that is it looks like the mandate they have been given by the by their owner Iqbal Survey, and I think that is why they know. I mean, every journalist knows there's something inside of you that knows how you're supposed to conduct yourselves, and they would have known that there was something wrong with them wearing ANC attire at an ANC event and taking pictures of it.
Yeah, as an expression of their support for the party as well. You know, it's, I mean, there have been other instances, for example, where Ferial was wearing the EFF beret at a DA, when she was speaking at a DA conference.
Yes.
You know, the context of that was not to show support for the EFF, but was to show that she wasn't there in a capacity to endorse the DA or to support the DA in any respect. So very different when you put the context of what they were trying to do, which was to show their support. Which then makes it quite difficult to then look at the independent titles and say, are they truly independent? You know, when they have, are willing to express their support on something like social media.
But the thing is that I don't think that they want to be independent. That's the difference.
So this is where I don't actually have a problem with them doing it, but then don't claim to be independent.
Yes.
I think that's the challenge, is that they express their support, but still claim to be, you know, completely independent and objective. I'm saying, I actually don't mind if you are, you know, support. I don't mind that there are publications who are pro-government. I think that it just creates a diversity of content. We'll see different news items coming up. I don't have a problem with that. But then don't go and call yourselves, you know, massively independent and objective.
I think in that case, then, you know, it has to be declared. Like, how in the US, Fox News has a certain approach and
a certain bias.
Yes. I was trying to be nice, but yes, they do have a certain bias. So their viewers know when they're watching Fox News, they know what to expect.
Yeah.
You know, it's like with Cliff Central, you know it's irreverent. You know it's out of the box radio. So you don't expect a kind of polite 70% positive news of
Sure, and the same thing in the UK as well. I mean, there's certain newspapers you know are going to be pro-Tory or pro-Labour, for example, and have had a history. And you know that when you pick it up, that's what you expect. It's and they're quite open about that.
Yes. So, you know, perhaps we've, you know, been, the South African media has been a bit conservative in the way it's been dealing with it, where we try to be all things to everybody. So, you know, the difference here is that if you want to wear ANC apparel and things like that, you're doing it as an individual, but it has consequences for the company because the company hasn't declared itself openly as being pro ANC. But senior people who represent the company, you see, the difficulty is then what then happens to reporters who fall under them, who want an interview with Musi Maimani or Julius Malema or whoever. And those people feel, but why should I be giving these people interviews when they are not going to represent me fairly because they already have a particular bias. So while Karima and Vukani do have, you know, their own choices to make and, you know, they old and ugly enough to do what they want. But the thing is that it does have consequences for everybody else in that company and the media in general, because all of us then have to, you know, deal with the constant debates about the leaning of the media, that the media has an agenda. And we all know that we're not a homogeneous group. Mm-hmm. We don't operate. We don't all sit together and discuss our stance on anything. And you saw, like, for example, on Marikana, there were very different ways that the South African media approached that massacre. So, you know, there's no possible way you can say that. But when people then brand the media as being biased, then they use these examples. And we all then have to carry that burden.
I think for me, one of the other issues that that come up from something like this that become evident is, and one of the arguments that Vukani and Karima put forward is that regardless of their affiliations or support for the ANC, they felt that they can still do their jobs and still put forward arguments, objective arguments, and still report or you know, edit in a way that doesn't create a bias. But the challenge is that when, for example, there's a financial interest, when a journalist has a financial interest in a story, they're usually asked not to participate or to declare that, you know, so that conflict of interest is known to the reader. Or, for example, if a publication is reporting on one of their shareholders, that interest, that financial interest is usually reported so that the reader is aware of that. And I think that, for me, is one of the other things, is that declaration, you know, isn't forthcoming. You know, it's not being put out there. And I think that's, you know, it's fine to have those political affiliations, but then, as we say, declare it.
Yes, but then, you know, what then divides us from being politicians ourselves? Why don't politicians just work as journalists then? The difference is that journalists have, you know, you're kind of wired differently. You're there to produce the news and tell all sides of the story. And if you have a particular vested interest, and we've seen the way that has, you know, had such a debilitating influence at the SABC, where there's this political interest influencing the editorial outcome. And we've seen how that has affected the product. And that is what is happening at independent newspapers, but also in terms of its credibility and the way people perceive what comes out of it. So even if they produce editorials and columns and, you know, breaking news stories that they may, you know, have worked hard on and, you know, wanted to present as actual news.
There'll still be a cloud. Well, there could be a cloud.
People will perceive it as big, as part of some agenda.
Especially when you take into account some of those recent controversies, when you look at, you know, a leader being pushed out of the Cape Times, Tony Weaver, Janet Hurd, and the apology to Max de Pryor. It's kind of, you're starting to see the evidence build in terms of people saying, well, hang on a second, these are examples of where it really does look like, you know, your political affiliations have caused the newspaper to take actions that they normally wouldn't have if they were truly independent.
And I think the interesting thing about this entire saga is that how it's brought up race issues as well, because all those people you mentioned happen to be white. So Vukani and Karima's defense is that, yes, we are doing something at independent newspapers. We are busy with the project of what they call transformation. I'm not sure if it is. And so they feel that they are justified in all those decisions because, you know, know, for them, it's a matter of transforming the company. So, you know, I think that has brought up a number of issues in the media, and I think it leaned over you. The Daily Mail carried Vugani Mdee's
response.
Yes, a very, very extensive 5,000 word response. You know, in which he was referring to things. I think it was an accusation even against us as the white media establishment. And then you had somebody like Ferial responding to that, you know, to say, you know, get real about this. Who exactly are you branding as what? And what is the justification for this? Because if you start boxing everybody in, you know, then you can't take anybody seriously. You cannot actually have a constructive debate on these issues, because that's not the issue. The issue is not who is asking the questions. It's whether or not you were right or wrong.
Whether the questions were valid.
Yes, whether the questions were valid, yes.
And the other point, and just finally before we round off on this, is how, and again going back to the arguments of being able to argue something objectively, even with these affiliations, is how do you do that in a story you don't publish? So the risk is that you don't publish a story because of those affiliations. How will you know that those, you know, the, you know, journalism is not only about what you print, it's also about what you don't print as well. And I think those are, that becomes another tricky issue, because you don't know what goes through the editor's mind when he or she decides not to run something that might be, you know, critical of the ANC, for example.
Yes. You know, I mean, there are all sorts of stories that come up. For example, there was a story this week about the president's, one of the president's wives, Mantuli. She's apparently been expelled. I don't know if you can expel a wife, but anyway, she's been expelled from the spousal office of the presidency. Now, that hasn't been confirmed as yet, but what it means is she's basically out of the cold. She's not getting financial support, you know, to whatever it
is. So divorced by any other name. Or
yes. Yeah. So, you know, and for example, that story, you know, it's very tricky to run, because it's difficult to verify and things. Now, people ordinarily who would have like a close relationship with the ANC and with the president would be best placed to write that story. You know, to be able to say what are the facts around the story, instead of getting it from different sources. But you find that, for example, people at independent newspapers, The New Age, SABC, who are close to the president, don't go near those types of stories, because there's no good way for it to come out.
Yeah.
You know, there's no good way for it to be presented. So while you may say, okay, I openly declare myself as being pro ANC or pro government or pro this and that, but then how is that used? Because it's not used to say it benefits the party, it's in the national interest, because we're putting out more information out there. Because although this looks like a big scandal story, you know, we all want to know what's going on with this wife, the thing is that it has implications for taxpayers' money, because the spousal support office it gets a dispersal of funds from the national treasury. So it has financial implications for the fiscus. So it is in our interest. But those media houses that are aligned and close to have a close relationship to the ANC and to the presidency, they won't run stories like that. So it does not benefit the public out there. That's the difference.
I'm glad you mentioned the financial implications as well, because, you know, what we have seen happen and pick up steam over the last couple of years is that, and it's pretty much always been the case with the SABC since it started, but is that a lot of government business does end up in those publications that are pro-government, which makes the lives of the independent and you know, sometimes fiercely critical publications like Daily Maverick or like the Mail and Guardian, you know, struggling to participate in those revenues just on the basis of the fact that, you know, deemed to be, you know, independent or critical of the government. And we're seeing a lot of that, you know, you pick up the New Age now, you know, maybe up to 80% of those adverts look like they are from a government department of some sort. The, you know, we've seen reports of Telkom spending huge amounts of money on a newspaper that doesn't even subscribe to the audited Bureau of Circulation. And so these are also some of the other issues that come out of having those sort of, you know, pro-government leaning publications.
Yeah, I think it's all part of how the power networks operate, because whether it's dealing with business and tenders or media and advertising, it's the same kind of formula. You play nicely and you support us, and you know, business sponsors you know gives back, and business and parastatals give back to the ANC, and you know, people who are in power, and the same thing. I think the same kind of formula works in the media, where you, if you play nicely, you're nice to us, we'll be nice to you.
Yeah, so not too much government spend coming the way of the Daily Maverick anytime soon. you've been to a couple of the Eskom briefings lately. We're supposed to be in a red week now, where Armageddon is supposed, electrical Armageddon is supposed to be upon us at this point in time. It really does look like there are some scary times ahead for us.
Oh, absolutely. But you know what? I'm starting to think Eskom is just messing with us now, because I went to this briefing last week, and they basically prepared us for a rolling, they don't, by the way, we're not allowed to say blackouts anymore, because blackouts mean something else and they feel very insulted by it. So it's rolling rotational.
It's the Eskom race card. You can't say blackouts.
Yeah, you can't say blackouts. So it's rotational load shedding, which was supposed to happen this week, because they basically have admitted that what they've done since about 2010 is failed to maintain the entire power system. So the plants out there, however many they are basically, you know, running on a wish and a prayer at the moment. And that is why they fail so easily, because they're not maintained, and the machinery is basically running, you know, on full power all the time.
And these maintenance jobs were actually part of Thabo Mbeki's era, when a lot of that maintenance, because this stuff happens like in 10-year cycles.
Well, Thabo Mbeki era, the problem that happened there was that the Eskom was red flagging that there should be new generation capacity, which was ignored by the Mbeki administration. That's where that was their big problem. The maintenance, for some reason, they it's not very clear as to why they abandoned their maintenance schedule. But one of the reasons they gave last week was because of the 2010 World Cup. Now, they said that they couldn't afford for the lights to go out anywhere around the country during that time. And that's why they kept it on and, you know, kept the entire system at full power. And so, because they said South Africa would have been a different country now had the power gone out then. Problem is, that was for 1 month. You know,
And it's, or now, 2 months, let's say 2 months.
And it's now like 4.5 years later. So like, what happened after that?
In that time,
So everybody went home, and you know, there was actually another World Cup in Brazil. In that time, I don't know why they then failed to maintain the system. So that's the one of the reasons, okay? They also have a financial crisis, so they don't have, so because the system is not properly maintained, they are using diesel turbines at the moment to generate power, and that's extremely expensive. So it's basically just you know, chewing up my funding, and they do not have that funding any longer. They've run out of funds, so that's why load shedding now. The way they basically put up a graph showing that every day from this week until the end of April, load shedding is possible and is probably going to happen. But now, like from this week, they're saying, okay, the system is tight, but we do have enough, but maybe tomorrow, maybe the next day. So you never really know. Yeah. Although they were saying that, you know, all this will happen sort of on a planned basis unless something goes wrong. So unless like another silo falls down.
Or they run out of diesel.
Or they say it gets very cold and everybody switches on the heaters, then you know it can put out the whole. Yeah. But they're saying that they're embarking on this whole rotational load shedding thing to keep so that they can do some maintenance and so to keep the entire system working. So there's this whole fear in the country that there will be a blackout. What a blackout means is that at the moment they need about 30,000 megawatts of power to keep the country running. So if there's a national blackout, it means they produce 0 megawatts. Mm. And it means that the entire country goes dark. And if that happens, it'll go out for about 2 weeks. So there'll be nothing being generated. So, can you imagine that? Like the hospitals, the banks will go down.
Daily Maverick.
Cliff Central, nothing will operate. It means that it will be, they claim it will be take 2 weeks to kick up again for it to start working. But I don't know if that is because what would be the consequences? Because, for example, there'd be a massive crime spree because security fences won't work.
Yeah, and just the impact on the economy,
would
be catastrophic.
Yes, because banks would stop operating, all financial institutions, all businesses would shut down. There'd be absolutely, it would be Armageddon. It would. it is very frightening that, that the system is very fragile at the moment. And all they're saying is that, consumers need to be careful and be mindful about how they use energy and things. But clearly that's not going to solve the problem. And South Africans have been very responsive and reduced consumption. But there is a bigger problem. There needs to be more generation capacity. They need to step up the maintenance. They need to get Medupi and Kusile to online. And now, they keep postponing when it's going to start up. Medupi's new date for startup is sort of mid-year this year, but it'll go into a period of testing. So, it'll come onto the grid and then switch off, come on and switch off, while they test, but it only produced about 600 power watts. It can't deal with the shortfall that's required.
We had Chris Yelland in here on a show once, and he was saying that at its maximum capacity, Eskom produces more than what the country needs at the moment. The problem is that it's not producing at a high enough level because there are so many power generating plants that are offline or down or closed for maintenance or supposed to be. And that's the challenge. It's just, we don't actually... We do need them now so that we can bring those online while we fix the ones that aren't working. But essentially, if the grid had been properly maintained, we'd be very far from having these issues.
The thing is that Eskom, it's becoming clearer and clearer, is so badly managed. Mm. And that was the funny thing about last week when we were at the briefing, is that Deputy President Ramaphosa had been visiting them earlier in the day. And he said, Eskom is a glorious company. And, I was just thinking that
of course it is. The 20 million rand bonuses that the CEOs have been getting for the last 5 years.
But how badly do you need to stuff up and be at your job, to get a reprimand?
Well, I imagine they'd done their jobs properly. Imagine what kind of bonuses they would have got then. The GDP of Lesotho. Here you go.
I think they're sulking at the moment because they weren't allowed to go to the World Economic Forum. Yeah. So.
And pretty soon we're off to Cape Town. We've got the State of the Nation address stroke boxing match that we're all expecting. What do you think is going to go down there? We're starting to hear some overtures coming from the EFF and, ahead of the State of the Nation address. What do you expect going?
The newlywed Julius Malema addressed a media briefing last week as well. The EFF is back in business. And that was one of the main things that we wanted to know from him last week is what is the game plan? Because I think he stole the show last year in the way he launched the EFF, presented it as this militant group that turned the parliament upside down, and was a guy that was able to put President Jacob Zuma on the spot in the way nobody else has been. So I think there's a lot of pressure on him at the moment to keep up the pressure and to keep up the standard he himself has set. So they have this massive game plan, one of which is the whole pay back the money campaign of theirs. And they're saying that the last time they tried to ask President Zuma was in August last year, and they wanted to ask him when he would be paying back the money, and that whole session was disrupted and the riot police came into parliament and all that. So they are aggrieved that from August to now, there hasn't been another opportunity. The president hasn't returned to continue answering those questions he didn't answer. So the first opportunity where he will be back in parliament will be the State of the Nation address. Now, that is normally a very, formal, prim and proper,
high fashion.
Yes, you know, it's very scripted. Yeah. It used to be normally, you know, during the day on a Friday. But under the Zuma administration, they moved it to Thursday nights because they wanted the whole country to be at home and watching the president speak so that everyone can be bored to death by what he's saying. I think this year would be vastly different because Julius Malema made it very clear at the media briefing last week that they're not going to let pay back the money go. And they're going to demand an answer at the State of the Nation address. So we were asking him, but like, how would you do that? Because, you know, that event is very formal. The MPs sit down, they first parade up and down with their clothes, high fashion clothes, and take pictures and twirl around. And then they go into parliament, they sit down, the premiers come in, the judges come in, and then the deputy president comes in with a whole entourage, and then the president comes down with a whole entourage, and then the president gets up, he speaks, he gives his long address, and everybody goes outside and bitch about how bad it was outside. So that's how, you know, that's the formula every year. So at what point do you speak? Yeah. It's also a joint sitting of the House. So it's the National Assembly plus the National Council of Provinces. So it's not the normal parliamentary sitting where you get to ask questions. So he says no. As soon as the president gets to the podium and starts to speak, they will rise on a point of order and say, Mr. President, you have not completed answering these questions. We're not going to answer it. So that's how it's going to happen. Except that you know that the speaker's not going to give them an opportunity to speak. And once she tries to stop them speaking, they're going to kick up a fuss. Mm-hmm. And then she's going to try and boot them out of the house. Mm-hmm. And then the police are going to come in. So
they'll be like already prepared for, for this as well. Yes. So
we asked, one of the journalists asked, so are you going to bus in people, you know, to make a whole spectacle outside? And he said, no, we are the elected representatives of the economic freedom fighters. 25 of us would make the point, and we're prepared to make that point in Parliament. So, they're not planning for a circus outside to have, because Parliament's response is to just throw a net of security around Parliament to prevent any kind of disturbance of violence. So Julius is saying, no, but that's not what we want. We don't want like people to come and cause chaos and like, you know, start tearing down buildings or whatever it is. He said if their supporters want to come to Parliament, they're welcome to come, but that's not their game plan. Their game plan is just to confront the President in Parliament. It looks quite predictable how it will play out, that they'll just get escorted out of the house. But I don't know if it's going to happen that way. I really don't know. Like between now and then, you know.
Well, if any of last year's goings on are anything to go by, I mean, anything could happen. We could see a free-for-all again.
Last time's free-for-all wasn't, it was mostly DA MPs who were involved in the free-for-all, you know. And it was sort of new DA MPs suddenly discovering the struggle and thinking they were in 1976. So it was, it was quite hysterical.
Yeah. We've also, I want to touch on Jay-Z this year. I mean, we've looked at pictures and videos from now versus a couple of years ago and seen, you know, a marked deterioration in what looks like could be his health. You know, it could also just be, you know, I mean, he's
72
now. He's getting on. Mm. Is there a likelihood that they could use the health thing as a way to usher in some new leadership in the ANC? Are they getting to that point where they're thinking about it? Could we see that happen?
You see, it would make sense for so many reasons, mostly because I think the Zuma administration has fared so badly and there's so little faith in his leadership. Mm. And I think the ANC knows that. But, you know, I think that there is so much dependence on the power networks around him being sustained that trying to sort of take him out of the equation now in an early exit would unsettle that. Because I think there would be a fight back from, you know, ANC leadership at various levels who are quite comfortable where they are. So, you know, at national levels, the cabinet, at provincial levels, you know, the premiers, the MECs, the mayors, and then at ANC, that's at government level, at ANC level as well, you know, the chairpersons and the secretaries will control municipalities, will control provinces. So if you take suddenly pull Jacob Zuma out of that equation, it unsettles the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It means that the factions that are all aligned to him would, you know, would be on uncertain ground. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the ANC would take that risk now. And the thing with, you know, if they would do it anytime soon, the obvious candidate is Cyril Ramaphosa to take over after him. The problem with that is that Cyril Ramaphosa doesn't have universal support in the ANC. Mm. So there will be a fight back, particularly from hardcore Zuma supporters, to having him run the country and the ANC. The second thing is they don't know what his agenda is at the moment. You know, he's just basically falling in line between the president and doing everything he's instructed to do. He's fighting fires. He's doing his job.
Well, we've seen what happens when you step out of line.
Yes.
You know.
Exactly.
Even a toe out of line against the Zuma faction.
Exactly.
You get mowed down quicker than...
The difference is what then happens when the boss is not there and Ramaphosa is then holding the reins. So I think there's too much uncertainty from inside the ANC. So will he maintain these power networks? Would he maintain, you know, the businesses that benefited from the Zuma administration? Is he going to benefit that? Or is he going to be his own man and start changing things? The thing is that with him, he's been out of politics for about 18 years. So people don't really know who, you know, what is his own interest and whether he would act in. So would he, for example, try and support and lean towards the business community, or would he, for example, he's been working with COSATU now to, you know, stitch up their problems. He comes from the National Union of Mine Workers. Would he go back to his roots and, you know, suddenly start favoring ordinary workers? We don't know that, and he hasn't said anything about that. He's basically just falling in line with the ANC agenda for now.
And also, to, you know, potentially taking into account any outcomes from the Farlam Commission as well, in his role in the tragedy that happened at Marikana.
Yes, I mean everybody's awaiting, you know, to see what that will say about him. But you know, I don't know. I don't think there was sufficient evidence presented there that would hold him culpable in any kind of criminal way, because that is the only way that would have major consequences for his political future, is if there is if the judge does recommend criminal action against him.
Do you think we'll see anyone, you know, sort of, you know, be held accountable?
I think so. I think the judge was showing irritation towards the conduct of the police in particular. But I don't know about anybody else. I don't know about the company, you know, people in cabinet and things, you know, the various ministers who appeared before the commission. But, you know, it's difficult to say. And also because the judge gave so little away, you know, during the commission. And he, you know, he's an old conservative judge. So he knows the game. He knows not to give too much away. But we also don't know how much political pressure has been born on him, because this is not a court of law. It's a commission of inquiry, you know. So all he does is he prepares a report, which then goes to the president to be acted on. It's not like a judgment.
And
that
we've seen
comes
what
up.
Happens to some reports
exactly.
that end
they
up on the
They get buried for years and years, and you don't get to see it. They get edited, you know, and the outcomes are different, and they are not acted on.
Well, you get the SIU to do their own report to counter the independent report.
Yes. So, you know, there's no telling. So, what's going to be the consequences from the Marikana Commission?
We've got municipal elections coming up next year. What do you think the biggest issues are going to be around those, especially in Gauteng?
I think that particularly the EFF is going to start kicking up a lot of dust on a number of issues. But, at the moment, they are talking about occupation of land that is currently unoccupied for landless people. And they're actually going to be setting up a fund, because they know this is illegal. They know it's not allowed under South African law. You can't just basically go and, you know, put up a house on a vacant plot. But they want to do that to kind of increase the pressure on government and to be able to change the ball game a little bit. Because at the moment, what happens is that especially with municipalities where service delivery is failing and things like that. So you have like problems with water and electricity and housing and things. So you just get communities go out in the streets, you know, they protest, the police comes, deal with them, and then it dies down. So that's basically the pattern, you know, you get in various communities. The strange thing about South Africa, though, is that those protests don't really affect voting patterns. And that is why the ANC has been able to maintain its dominance in all elections, because although communities become disgruntled, it is difficult for them to make the psychological break to, you know, supporting the ANC. But I think what the EFF is doing now is that it's presenting alternatives, although these alternatives may not be legal. But they're saying, they basically put out a message to people who are homeless, who are unemployed, who have no hope, that rally behind us, you may get arrested or you may get a house. You know, so what's the chance you're going to take? So for people out there who have been, you know, living in poverty for the last 21 years.
As you say, living without hope, basically.
Yes. And there is somebody who's saying something different, who's coming up with a different script, you know, which doesn't just say you get pounded by the police and you then go home with a few bruises. So you may get pounded by the police, but you may end up with that land eventually because here's this guy who's putting himself out there and saying, let's go, let's just do it. And then they're doing the same thing with mines. They're saying, let's take over the mines. And, you know, the ANC, as you've seen that, you know, what happened at Marikana and other areas is that the extreme violence that came out of there is due to the extreme frustration of people living under those conditions for so many years, again, with no hope. And the mines are not controlled by the state. The mines are controlled mostly by private companies. So the state is meant to hold those private companies to account in terms of living conditions, in terms of what they put back into communities. But that's not happening. So the EFF is basically ratcheting up the pressure now to say, if you're not going to give us proper housing there, we're going to build it ourselves. We're going to take it. We want the dividends from these mines are producing in our areas, because those are historically our areas, and you came and took it, and you're doing business on those areas, and we don't benefit from it. So, you know, I think that, nobody quite knows exactly how this will play out, because maybe the EFF will try it a couple times, you know, try and occupy a land, like go up and confront a mine and say we want this and that. And, you know, if they get arrested, maybe other people will be too scared to do it. Or maybe it'll start a wave of something we haven't seen in this country. And what, you know, the thing about South Africa is things really catch on. We've seen it with the xenophobic attacks in 2008. It started with one incident, I think in Alex, and it went countrywide. And there was no formal organization behind that. It's just, you know, this uprising, from the ground. You light a match and it catches on all over the country because of the high level of frustration and poverty in the country.
We've seen the local ANC government do an about turn, or, you know, in reviewing ETOLs, you know, which could be classified as an about turn, you know, of the ANC at national level. And, you know, are we looking at that? And you mentioned the EFF jumping on things like land distribution, as topics, as items to contest the municipal elections. You know, do you get a sense that the ANC at the local government level is worried about Gauteng?
I think they're very worried about Gauteng. I think, you know, I think that if they do lose control of Johannesburg and Pretoria, it's a major psychological blow to the ANC. Pretoria is the capital city of the country. Johannesburg is the biggest economic hub. So, you know, it's areas of, you know, where there's large amounts of money. You know, and I think that they're going to try and do everything possible to be able to prevent losing. And we saw that the voting patterns in the 2014 elections showed that there is a very real danger of Johannesburg and Pretoria being lost. So, look, I think that the Gauteng government had to respond to a situation where there was kind of a gun to their heads. And they had to look at what was the underlying cause of the disgruntlement. And yes, some of the problems are not different from anywhere else in the country, you know, unemployment and poor housing and service delivery problems and things. But eTolls, I think, is a phenomenon on its own. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also, it represents so much more. It, you know, it represents the state not listening to the people. And I think that is why David Makura went the route he did, is to say that that is a very bad message that went out there, that we're not listening. So let's listen. So that's why they went through that process.
And the implications for them at a local government level are much greater than the national government level.
Absolutely.
Because we could see them losing the province on back of things like eTolls.
And you saw, you see it in the Western Cape now, that once the DA gained control of the Western Cape, it's very, very difficult to get it back. Mm. You know, and because the DA then uses its control of the province and the municipalities to you know, continue entrenching their power. And they know it from how they control other areas around the country, like KwaZulu-Natal. The ANC was not in control of KwaZulu-Natal in the first few years of democracy. The IFP was. And, you know, they had to work really, really hard and win it bit by bit, municipality by municipality, until they got, you know, the control of the province, and now it's one of their biggest support bases. So the thing is that the reverse has been happening in Gauteng, where it's very dominant ANC, but they're losing control. And I think that what's been happening in areas like Soweto is that the more it gets developed and the more people move from the strata of working class to middle class, you know, they become more informed, they become more knowledgeable about, you know, what's going on in the country, and, you know, how deep the crises are. And
also that time frame, you know, of liberation become further, you move further and further away.
The voting base is getting younger. So the memory of apartheid is receding. You know, so people are making decisions based on what's happening now rather than the historical context. So, I think that Gauteng is going to be really, they have to deal with Gauteng differently from how they deal with the rest of the country. Now, the thing is that, you know, the Gauteng leadership of the ANC, Paul Mashatile and David Makura, I think that they try and box clever. They read the signs and they react to it. Whereas with the ANC at national level, it's like, we in control. Gwede is like, oh, I don't care. I still, you know, I run the show.
There's much more measured arrogance in their approach to dealing with, you know, the issues at hand.
Yes. Whereas I think with Paul Mashatile and David Makura, they know that how much they stand to lose and how difficult it will be to get back. So I think that, you know, from the ANC provincial conference, conference last year, as well as, this eTolls process, you know, they are trying to go back to the roots, to reach out, to make contact with communities, to find out what exactly is going on, just to feel the pulse. And this eTolls is the major issue. But I think that what they've realized also is that it is not so easy because of the powers allocated to provinces at national level. It is not so easy just to scrap it. So that commission now has produced a number of recommendations, but it hasn't recommended the complete scrapping of eTolls. So, you know, it's going to take also a lot of hard work. If they're going to implement those recommendations, it's going to take a lot of hard work to try and even sell that. Because the problem now is a blanket refusal to participate in the eTolls process, rather than saying, oh, give us another discount. That's not what people are saying.
Yeah, I think, you know, there was a suggestion somewhere, I can't remember where I saw it, but with the oil price dropping to such crazy lows and obviously the petrol price coming down, now would be a very good time to implement the fuel levy and to collect it. So on the next drop it by slightly less than you would have, and you can start collecting, because we need that money anyway. That money needs to come from somewhere. You know, the money to maintain and to keep up the infrastructure.
Yes, but I think the objection from people like Wayne Duvenage and Kosate and things is that once you get into the system, they're going to be paying for 20 years and who knows how much longer. Because, you know, you can't then get out of it.
Yeah, but the main objection was the way that they were – I don't think people were objecting to paying for it.
No.
It was the way that they were implementing those
yes, but
those
you see, like, for example,
changes.
Now the oil price is down. But then in a year's time or 2 years' time or 5 years' time, that may have changed. And the economics of the country and of the province would have changed. But people will still be paying, you know. And you can't – at that point, you can't then – say, let's reduce it further. Mm. You can't negotiate at that point. The only time to negotiate is now, you know, and set the terms and conditions now. And that will be in place for at least 20 years.
Yeah, look, and who knows what's going to happen with oil price in 20 years' time.
Yes. And if there is a change of government, for example, because there's no guaranteeing that the ANC will still be in government in 20 years.
That's true. We're almost about to wrap up. Just briefly looking ahead for the rest of the year, what are the major things that you're looking forward to looking out for on the political horizon?
Okay, so it's the State of the Nation address. I think that's the major thing. You know, when you want to be optimistic about the country, you think, okay, so maybe there's going to be announcements as to how to deal with the energy crisis, how to deal with the failing economy, because things are looking really bad. You know, but you just know that after so many years, we're not looking forward to the State of the Nation address for those reasons. You're looking because of this whole sideshow that's going to happen, you know? But 2 weeks after that is the budget. And I think that's when, you know, the real straight talk will come from the finance minister. So that's, I think that's a major thing to be able to watch at the end of
February. Whether he'll tinker with any of the tax rates.
And he is going to. Yeah. You know, I think taxes are going to go up. And I think.
It's a question of how much.
Yes. And, you know, and they may, because they have been investigating an entire reform of the tax system. So, you know, you may see an entirely different system. Who knows, you know? So I think that is one major event. The other thing is that, the ANC in June is having, what they call a National General Council. So that is a mid-year conference between its national conferences. So the last one was Mangaung in 2012, and the next one will be in 2017 when they elect a new leadership. So they have National General Councils midterm between these conferences to be able to evaluate how well they've done or not. Yeah. The thing about National General Councils is that you can't elect new leadership unless something happens.
But is there a jockeying for position that happens
No. It's more a power play. Like the last one, the last National General Council that happened in 2010 is actually what started the process of Julius Malema's expulsion, because that's where he kicked up a fuss about nationalization. The one prior to that in 2005 was where the rebellion against Thabo Mbeki started. Because there was an upsurgence from the floor of the conference against Mbeki. So, yes, they can be very dramatic, but they don't have – you can't have a change of leadership. But something happens there. They have a track record of these things being really dramatic. So this is going to be winter 2015. I think that's going to be a major event to watch. The other thing that's going to be happening is COSATU, and it's now kind of rather tiring housekeeping issues, but it's scheduled to have an elective congress towards the end of this year, around September of this year. But the rebels within COSATU are demanding a special congress, so you may have two conferences inside COSATU to be able to sort out its troubles. So that should also be fun to watch.
Well, that's been an intimate hour of going through all the major issues in the country at the moment. Ranjini, thank you so much for joining us again. It's always great to have you in studio. That's been the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Catch us at dailymaverick.co.za or sign up to our newsletter first thing, or Daily Dose from the Cliff Central website.
CliffCentral.com.